Hi, this is Alan Shartak, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Brian Early, an assistant professor in the political science department at Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, University of Albany, and the founding director of the Project on International Security, Commerce, and Economic Statecraft. Dr. Early is also the author of Busted Sanctions, Explaining Why Economic Sanctions Fail, Stanford University Press, if you want to get it, which explains how and why other countries around the world have undercut the United States' economic sanctions with the trade and aid they provide to sanctioned states. Welcome, Dr. Brian Early.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Alan. I'm very happy to be here today.
So, Brian, tell me, how did your interest get started in sanctions?
Well, my interest was actually going back to graduate school when I had an opportunity to travel to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And I was over there on a project to look at how the small little political entity, the small emirate, had played a major role in proliferating nuclear technology to Iran. And what I found when I was over in Dubai was that not only were a lot of sensitive nuclear and military-related technologies going through this tiny little emirate, but a massive amount of American products that were subject to sanctions were being sold to Dubai and then retransferred or re-exported to Iran to help the country get around sanctions. And when I got back from the country and started to look in at the history, this was around 2005, I found that this had been going on for decades, and that not only was this phenomenon of sanctions-busting trade, as I called it, taking place in Dubai, but it was going on all over the world. And there was very little appreciation of the damage that this type of trade was doing to the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions policies.
And yet, Brian, we read and hear, and had an expert on Israeli-Iranian relations on the other day, who claims that these sanctions are pretty effective to the point where Iran wants to get out from under them.
So I think if you look at the sanctions against Iran, you had a number of distinct periods. You had the sanctions that the U.S. government first put in place during the Iran hostage crisis, and it's argued that those were actually pretty effective in convincing the Iranians that they wanted to release the hostages. But then we got into a much longer period of sanctions starting in the 80s and then continuing on through the 90s, where the U.S. government was putting sanctions laws on the books, but not really enforcing them very strongly. And so it was over these several decades that Iran was able to build up a really effective set of commercial networks that allowed them to circumvent sanctions. And so, I mean, you had several decades where U.S. sanctions were trumpeted by American policymakers as doing something against Iran, but not really being effective. I would say, though, that in the past 5 to 7 years, U.S. policymakers had really begun to realize that the sanctions hadn't been that effective at achieving U.S. foreign policy goals. And they kind of shifted tack, started to impose stronger sanctions on financial areas, and gotten the Europeans to support the sanctions as well. So the more recent sanctions have been effective in causing a lot more in the way of economic damages to Iran's economy than they previously did.
So I notice around April 15th of every year, you have the Justice Department putting people in jail for not paying the taxes and not returning things. But I also notice that there's been a spate of prosecutions and convictions of people accused, Americans and others, getting around the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
And to make an example of them.
Yes. And so what you have had is a lot more effective enforcement and a lot more resources within the U.S. government devoted to going after not only individuals, but also a lot of large multinational banks and financial institutions that have played key roles in helping countries like Iran and Syria circumvent U.S. sanctions. So you have had a number of very large financial settlements by major banks that is part of, I think, the U.S. Treasury strategy of showing that the U.S. actually is going to enforce the sanctions laws on its books. And what's interesting is that a lot of the violations that these companies are being held accountable for are going back over a decade when it didn't really look like the U.S. really cared to enforce its sanctions. And so I think the U.S. government is getting the message out. And I think you're right that making these settlements and prosecutions so public, the U.S. government is trying to demonstrate its seriousness on the issue.
Now, the Iranians in these negotiations, their top leaders are saying, okay, we'll make a deal with you, but the day after the deal is made, we want you to lift all the sanctions. Is that going to happen?
I think it's going to be very difficult to get that passed through both branches.
Two Republican houses.
And I think that when the Supreme Leader came out with that statement, I think that influenced the Obama administration's opinion on whether or not you had to go and get congressional approval for that deal, because not all of the sanctions can be lifted via executive authority alone.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a real challenge that President Obama is going to have to sell the deal to Congress. On the flip side, if you're the Iranian government, you've been subject to U.S. sanctions for over three decades. You've had a very adversarial relationship with the United States, and you've also borne a great deal of economic costs, particularly in the past several years due to the sanctions. So this is the Iranians' big negotiating chip. And if they come out of this with only limited removal of the sanctions, then I don't think the deal is going to be perceived as being worthwhile from elements within their government.
We're talking to a very smart man, Professor Brian Early from the Rockefeller College at SUNY at Albany. One of the things I'm particularly interested in is who gets to react to sanctions in one of the affected countries. So, for example, obviously the government has issues with the sanctions, but what about the middle class person who is obviously going to either vote or not vote for their leadership, or in a case like Iran where there are limited elections, but they are elections. And certainly the Supreme Ayatollah knows if he's got trouble with his middle class. Well, what do you make of that?
I think this is one of the very challenging issues related to making economic sanctions effective. I mean, the countries and U.S. policymakers who impose economic sanctions would like middle-class voters in affected states to hold their leaders accountable for the policies that result in their countries getting sanctioned. But more often than not, leaders of sanctioned countries are able to use economic sanctions for a rally around the flag effect, to argue to their populations that our country is under attack from foreign powers. We need to consolidate political power. We need to support the government. And if you look at what Vladimir Putin has done in Russia, especially with the control that he's able to exert over the Russian media, that's exactly the tactic that he's taken. In places like Iran, I think that the populace has lived under sanctions long enough that they're a little bit more skeptical of their government and its policies when they are telling them that the sanctions are really something that they don't have control over and that they just have to be loyal to the government and they'll get through it. So I think that within Iran, you have an element of the populace that really has been suffering from the latest round of sanctions. And I think in supporting President Rouhani as president, one of the things that they were looking for was a political change that could lead to maybe some economic relief as well.
Yeah. In fact, one could make the argument that the Supreme Ayatollah permitted Rouhani to run and to win in that country because he knew it was time for change.
Yeah, I think that the political institutions in Iran are very complicated in terms of there being different sources of power in different constituencies. But I think that very little that's meaningful gets accomplished within Iran that doesn't have the Supreme Leader's ultimate support. Even if there can be differences in agreement, which you've occasionally seen from presidents with the Supreme Leaders over the years. Yeah, if this deal is going to happen, the Supreme Leader is going to have to sign off on it.
You opened up the door to Russia. Let's go there now.
Okay.
Obviously, you were right about your contention that Putin was using our sanctions against that country to bolster his nationalistic appeal to residents of the old Soviet Union, mm-hmm. who were seen as a world power. That's gone now. So the sanctions have actually become a tool for him.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that policymakers could learn from political scientists on this issue is that there's been a lot of research that has shown that economic sanctions can have a lot of counterproductive effects in affected countries. Economic sanctions have been found to be associated with greater human rights abuses within sanctioned countries.
Brian, do the people know that? Does the average guy on the street who owns a grocery store know that they're being punished for having the sanctions?
Not if they're aren't regular readers of political science journals. And I think that's one of the ways in which the people who study sanctions as academics, we need to do a lot better job of promoting the research that we're doing. Because I don't think that the harmful effects of sanctions are getting through to our policymakers that decide when to impose sanctions. And I don't think that it's necessarily understood by the people in sanctioned countries, the full scope of kind of social and in some cases even political effects that the sanctions have on their government's behavior.
So just to recap, you are saying that you think that sanctions, and I think I heard this right, that sanctions are more effective right now in Iran are sanctions than they are in Russia?
Yes, I would say so. I think that part of it is how Putin has been able to consolidate his authority and control within Russia during the sanctions and using them as an excuse for doing that. I mean, obviously, part of what has made the sanctions against both Iran and Russia as effective in imposing economic costs as they have been has been the low price of oil. And so that's been a real force magnifier for exacerbating the economic damages that both countries have experienced.
So let me ask you a question really quickly. All of a sudden, inexplicably, the Saudis open up the taps. And they say, okay, we are not going to control the price of oil right now. I've always suspected that that was done in conjunction with either the United States or other allies of the Saudis who really wanted to punish Putin. Do you think that's true?
It seems like a little too much of a coincidence, especially given the way in which it's helped U.S. sanctioning efforts, particularly against Iran, because the strengthening of the sanctioning effort against Iran preceded the strengthening of the sanctioning effort against Russia. But yeah, I mean, it either is an enormous fortuitous coincidence for the U.S. and the European Union's efforts, or there was some sort of political collusion that we're not being told about right now.
We're talking with Professor Brian Early of the Political Science Department at Rockefeller College in Albany, New York. Professor, the sanctions, I think I'm hearing from you, can be either tougher or not, depending on the country.
Yeah, and the nature of the sanctions that are imposed, I mean, can obviously be very light, or they can be much more comprehensive. And the willingness of those who impose them to go out and try to build a larger multilateral coalition of other partners to participate can also strengthen sanctioning effort. But part of it's just a factor of the sanctioned country's economy to begin with. So for a general factor that has tended to be associated with the effectiveness of economic sanctions, the smaller and less developed the country's economy is, the more likely sanctions are to work against it. So I mean, that's been very good for the United States if it's bullying smaller countries around the world with its economic sanctions. But if it tries to use economic sanctions against fellow countries with large economies like Russia, it's much harder to use sanctions to get them to change their policies.
You never know what the results, these are the law of unexpected consequences, are always there. So let's go to Cuba now. You know, we've had sanctions against Cuba for years. There are reasons for that. We have Florida, which could decide a presidential election, and Cuba. I guess the question I have for you is, I mean, I think that Cuba and Cubans were in favor of their regime, at least for a long time they were, and that sanctions sort of gave them solidarity.
Yeah. In my book, Busted Sanctions, one of the things that I look at is how economic sanctions actually kind of played a key role in Castro's decision making that he needed to develop a stronger relationship with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I mean, when Castro took power, the original nature of what the revolutionary government would be and what its political alignment to be was very much in question. And one
although
of the way,
not by a lot of people who thought he was a communist from the beginning.
Well, I think it's a question of how close he really wanted to tie himself to the Soviet Union as well. And I think that the sanctions provided a really significant motivation for his country to form that political marriage with the Soviet Union. And what's also interesting is Castro reached out to communist China as well. And so you saw initially during the 1960s, Castro playing off communist China and the Soviet Union trying to get better deals to help his government and his people survive the sanctions. ultimately, Castro decided that the Soviet Union would be a partner that could provide much more in the way of resources over the years. And that partnership, played a real dominant role in Cold War politics for the United States, and it continued to after the end of the Cold War. But in terms of your point that economic sanctions did provide kind of a unifying appeal that the Castro regime could make about why solidarity was needed from the people of Cuba, and also why kind of continuing to raise up the anti-U.S. banner was important. I think the sanctions played a very key role.
So if we take the sanctions off now and we say, no more sanctions, Cubans, what does that do?
Well, I think that there was a real turning point at the end of the Cold War when Cuba lost the patronage of the Soviet Union, and that in order to survive during the 1990s, it had to adopt some liberalizing economic reforms. Now, that hasn't necessarily proceeded smoothly. It's gone in fits and starts, and Cuba was able to get other patrons like Venezuela to support it. But I think that the Cuban people right now, I think, are somewhat primed for an opening up of their society and a change. And I think that removing the sanctions is going to be a key part of allowing greater liberalization. I think that sanctions have been an impediment to liberalization within Cuba, and that removing them is going to potentially help open the country up.
Now, liberalization is an interesting word. I see The Godfather Part II every once in a while, and I go back to Batista, and you know, I'm old enough to remember that quite well and the corruption that existed here. If we lift the sanctions and say to the Americans, okay, go in, do whatever you want, build hotels, build gambling casinos, do all of this stuff, will there be an unintended consequence here, or even an intended consequence?
Well, I think a little bit that makes this case different is that the Europeans have been in Cuba. So, I mean, Cuba hasn't been completely isolated from Western capitalist investment. I mean, the Europeans have been making a lot of money from doing business in Cuba, while their neighbors to the Cuba's neighbors to the north haven't been willing to do business with them. So I don't think it's going to be a major shock to Cuba to have the country opened up to U.S. investment and trade. I do think, though, that it will have a much more significant effect on the culture within Cuba, because I mean, sure, it's going to subject it to a lot more competition. There's going to be a lot more foreign visitors coming into the country, and some of the good things that Cuba's been able to do, like have a very good health infrastructure, have a lot of doctors. I mean, they've really built up some aspects of their government in a very good way. We'll have to see if that's sustainable when they open up their economy and open up their politics.
I'm sure you're right. Doctors don't make a lot of money in Cuba. They have a good healthcare system.
Yeah.
But you let everybody in, and we'll see whether or not, you know, there's recruiting going on.
Health tourism is very, very big in other parts around the world, and Cuba would be a prime place to take advantage of its location next to the United States.
And health tourism meaning you go there in order to get a better deal on an operation, for example?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah. Okay, Brian Early, let's talk a little bit about either unintended or intended consequences. I heard on the BBC that the pound is now at $1.05 as opposed to $1.50 against the American dollar. Do you see any connection between that and sanctions?
I guess I would say that particularly in the countries of Europe, you've had both a combination of the financial crisis and also the economic kind of turmoil with respect to Russia. I mean, we also have a much lower price of oil as well, which tends to be traded in U.S. dollars,
exactly,
which I think is linked to that as well.
So the real question to somebody like me or many of the people who is huddled around their radios listening or in the car right now is how much of that is intended and how much of it is unintended. In other words, is there a strategy session going on in the basement of the Pentagon or the Department of the Treasury right now, which they say, if we do these sanctions in Iran and we do them in particular Russia right now because of the price of oil, and we're mad at Putin, but also we're going to drive the price of the relative value of the pound down.
Well,
and I'm not sure we want to do that, by the way, only because it puts us into a bad trading situation with Europe, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's very difficult to be able to know that the policy actions you're going to take are going to have profound impacts on the global economy like that. So I'm not saying that there wouldn't be analysts within the U.S. government that might be looking downstream in terms of what the consequences of some of our sanctions policies are. But I'm not familiar with any evidence, or I haven't heard it, that is part of the deliberate grand strategy of U.S. policymakers. It could be, but I'm not familiar with that.
In your book, Unbusted Sanctions, what are your findings?
So what I argue in the book is that U.S. sanctions, despite the fact that the United States has the largest economy in the world and has been the most active user of economic sanctions, that even U.S. sanctions, given all of the advantages the United States government has, still have largely been only effective a third of the time they're employed, which is kind of a puzzle. Of we could think that when weaker countries employ sanctions that they just won't be able to impose ones that are costly enough or powerful enough. But the United States shouldn't have that problem. So what I go on in my book is try to explore the reasons why U.S. sanctions haven't been effective. And so I look at the other countries' responses in the rest of the world to U.S. sanctions as a major cause of why they failed. And I argue that there are states that I call sanctions busters that via their aid that they provide to sanction states, like the Soviet Union provided a great deal of foreign assistance to Cuba during U.S. sanctions in the Cold War, or trade-based sanctions busters who seek to profit from the sanctions the U.S. has imposed because the U.S. withdraws its market, creating lucrative opportunities for firms in the rest of the world to step in and trade with those parties who U.S. firms can no longer trade with. And so I argue that these sanctions busters have played a really persistent and pernicious role in undercutting the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions for the past 60 years. And one of the striking things that I find is that while U.S. adversaries tend to be the countries who are willing to step in and provide significant amounts of aid to countries that the U.S. government has sanctioned, that it's actually the United States' own allies that are the countries who have been most willing to commercially capitalize on American sanctions through stepping in to fill the void left when the U.S. sanctions foreign countries.
We're talking to Professor Brian Early, SUNY at Albany in the Political Science Department. Brian, there are these countries where we really mean it, and there may be some where we really don't mean it.
Yeah, and I think that's actually another problem that has grown within the U.S. kind of foreign policy strategy in using economic sanctions. Economic sanctions tend to be one of the first policy options that American leaders turn to when they have a problem with the policies of foreign governments. It's kind of a sanction first and figure out what's going on later type of mentality. And economic sanctions are relatively easy to impose. Both Congress can impose them. The president can impose them. There are often few upfront costs that are recognized. Occasionally, you'll have a body like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who will try to mobilize to prevent sanctions, like they did in the case of the sanctions against Russia.
Because their thinking was?
Because it would hurt U.S. business interests.
So there are specific U.S. business interests, right?
Yes. But most of the time, those interest groups aren't effectively able to influence U.S. policymakers. And in the case of Russia, they weren't successful.
So if you get a key, I'm just making this up, of course, but if you had a key senator from a tobacco state and you're putting stuff on Cuban cigars, that could have profound effects on the business of that state.
Yes, it could. The question is whether that one senator is going to be able to effectively take a political stand, particularly if the country that's under the threat of sanctions has done some bad things.
Sure.
Are they going to be able to stake their political credibility on it to block those sanctions? And is there going to be a large enough political coalition to try to prevent that as well? And oftentimes, sanctions tend to be pretty easy policies for even Congress to roll out, especially if the sanctions are maybe targeting financial institutions or individual leaders within countries, as opposed to maybe sensitive commercial areas that would upset kind of U.S. business sectors.
So they work in nation states. The question is, can they work in other places? For example, we have ISIS now, which is hardly a country. They're heinous killers. They're cutting people's heads off. The American people are furious. And Boko Haram in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. But these are not states. So sanctions don't work there.
I mean, this is a case where economic sanctions might not necessarily be able to change the group's behaviors, but they might be able to at least limit the group's ability to obtain resources.
How so?
So if you take ISIS in Iraq, if they have control over oil and they want to sell it on the international market to gain revenues to support themselves, it's in the U.S. and government's interest and also many of the countries in the world's interest to make it very, very hard for ISIS to sell its oil. It doesn't mean that there won't still be sanctions-busting companies or traders that are willing to
That's
to
traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S?
Yes.
Or not A-I-T-O-R-S?
Oh. It depends on what perspective you have on the validity of the sanctions. But you make it much harder and much costlier for those groups to gain revenue. So are they going to get the groups to give up their bad activities in those cases? No. But will it diminish their resources and be part of maybe a larger strategy to degrade the group's power and ultimately hopefully defeat them? I think sanctions actually can play a minor role and certainly not determinative role, but I think they're helping in those cases.
So just to follow along with your thesis here, the Turks may be buying some of that oil.
Mm-hmm.
And if they see the possibility of sanctions, although they are a very close ally of the United States in things military and otherwise, they might be dissuaded from buying that oil? No, not
probably
really.
Not. I mean, the Turks have been buying Iranian oil. And I mean, this is one of those cases where even the alliance with the United States has not disincentivized the government or the people within the country from capitalizing on profitable trade that's available to them. I mean, one of the ironic things of economic sanctions is the more powerful, the more comprehensive you make the sanctions, the more lucrative it becomes for those who are willing to take the risk to trade with the sanctioned entities. And so, I mean, the profits are out there for those who are willing to take them and to take the risk necessary to do that business.
Can we have some examples?
So if we go back to the Cuban example earlier, I mean, while there's so much attention that was focused on the aid that the Soviet Union provided to Cuba during the Cold War, you had close American allies like Japan, like Great Britain, like Spain, who were doing an enormous amount of business with the Castro regime. You look at the current sanctions against Russia right now, and part of Russia's strategy articulated by Vladimir Putin to respond to the sanctions was to form larger, more robust commercial connections with countries in Eastern Asia. And Japan has been one of those countries that Russia has succeeded in strengthening commercial ties with. You also had a Russian-China oil distribution deal that was signed as well. So, and China is not necessarily a close American ally, but if the profits are out there, there are going to be both countries and individuals who will always be incentivized to exploit them. And that's why imposing economic sanctions is so difficult. There will always be someone out there willing to step in and intervene on a sanctioned state's behalf.
Let's talk a little bit about the sanctions as a concept. You've been terrific about explaining what our policy on sanctions are. Are we the only ones who do sanctions?
No, we're not the only country, although I would say that we're, like I mentioned earlier, we rely on sanctions more than any other country in the world and have done so since World War II. A lot of other countries would find it difficult to afford imposing as many sanctions as the United States currently has ongoing. But the other party that's now kind of the leading sanctioner in the world is the European Union. The EU has grown to rely on economic sanctions fairly frequently to deal with political challenges, and I think it
monopolistic challenges, right?
Yes. And what I find really kind of ironic about the European Union, though, is that when the U.S. government imposes sanctions and the European Union is not supportive of them. The countries who are members of the EU are the most likely in the world to become major trade-based sanctions busters to undercut the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions. And yet the EU has become a major sanctioning party itself. And one of the striking things is that when the EU does impose sanctions, its members do listen, and its members do get on board. And so I would say that one of the main reasons that the sanctions against Iran have really started to bite in the past 5 years is that the U.S. effectively got the European Union to start imposing sanctions and to cut off a lot of a major pipeline of trade that Iran had been relying upon. So sanctions are used by other countries, but the United States and the European Union are really the most prominent countries that rely upon them. Russia has also imposed counter-sanctions in retaliation for those imposed by the U.S. and Western Europe, particularly targeting agricultural products in the United States and Europe. And they've actually had limited effects much more in Europe. But yeah, I think sanctions are kind of a policy tool of the privileged rich countries within the international community.
So the United States is number one in the world in terms of economy, but China is number two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does China do sanctions?
China has engaged in some limited forms of what we'd call economic coercion. So if you remember the rare metals incident a while back, in which China, which is one of the world's primary producers of rare metals, decided that it was going to cut back on its exports. You could argue that was a form of sanction
or blackmail
But yeah. But I mean that's what sanctions are. They're twisting other parties' arms to bully them into changing their behavior. So China does have a lot of leverage. It hasn't been a major user of economic sanctions, though, up until this point. I think so much of China's strategy has been sell to the rest of the world that I don't think that they really have viewed an aggressive sanctioning strategy as being consistent with their interests.
Professor Brian Early, SUNY, let me ask you this question. If you were called before the Congress of the United States, and I certainly expect with your expertise, it will happen. And they said to you, Professor, are these ideas of sanctioning good or bad? Are they more risky than they're worth? You would say?
I would say that more often than not, economic sanctions don't accomplish their objectives and can actually make the situation worse. There are a limited number of cases when the U.S. government is willing to truly commit.
Really, really means it.
Really, really means it. And is willing to accept a lot of costs, make significant political investments in building the type of coalition that's needed.
Twist the arms of
their allies. And that's difficult. That can be very difficult to do. And it takes a sustained effort. And very few times in U.S. history has the U.S. government been willing to do that. And even when it does, you can still have spoiler states like the Soviet Union in the case of Cuba who can step in and undermine the effectiveness of sanctioning efforts. So they're an easy policy tool to use, but they're often not a successful one to employ to redress the foreign policy challenges that the United States confronts.
So if we don't want to put troops and boots on the ground, and people are looking at the Congress and at the president and saying, do something, this is a convenient thing to do.
Yes, and you've identified the Goldilocks trap, right? You have some foreign policy challenges where diplomatic statements enough are not alone to assuage your domestic constituencies or international audiences, and using military force simply is off the table and unacceptable. And sanctions are kind of right in the middle of that, where you're doing something, you can see that something is being done. And so policymakers are like, okay, this is an appropriate measured response. The problem is it's an appropriate measured response that often is not going to be effective at achieving the goals that are sought.
So, Brian Early, Mario Cuomo used to say to me, you know, the bad politicians hit you, and then that's as far as they go. But the good politicians can think six moves in advance. They can figure out, he's going to do this to me, and then I'll have to do this to him. Then he's going to do this to me. Then I'll do this to him. So this whole argument and the whole concept that you've been raising with us today, which is fascinating, is how much does the government really know? In other words, are they stupid? Do they know that there won't be these reactions and that we won't create coalitions and that we won't have people double-crossing us or Japan taking advantage of this? Or do they know it all?
So this is one of the really interesting things that I saw while I've spent a decade writing the book, is that...
Really? 10 years to write
10 years to write this book.
Whoa! Where were you doing your dissertation?
So I began my dissertation at the University of Georgia, and then I went to... had a research fellowship at Harvard University, where I wrote my dissertation, and then I came here to the University at Albany. But there were a lot of smaller projects that ended up feeding into this book.
Okay. So it took you 10 years to do all of this.
And so what I saw was that there were... individuals within the U.S. government, particularly the U.S. Treasury, that began to get a lot more sophisticated in their thinking about how to use economic sanctions and, in particular, how to identify the parties that could be influenced to stop their efforts to facilitate sanctions-busting trade. So I mentioned the foreign financial institutions. The U.S. has an enormous amount of leverage in the financial industry because so much of international commerce takes place using dollars or takes place with transactions that go through U.S. Financial firms. There was a recognition within the U.S. Department of Treasury that while it might be very, very difficult to convince traders in the Middle East who are importing products from Canada or Venezuela to stop doing it, you might be able to convince the banks that were playing a key role in financing and putting those transactions together that if they were cooperating and helping those transactions take place, that they were effectively violating U.S. laws and that behavior needed to stop.
Well, we do know that the banks have been considered by this country's policymakers as too big to fail.
Yes.
And therefore, those responses to some of the activity that has been screwing things up has to be measured. They don't go all the way.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And I think that part of the strategy is that you have large $100 million fines or in some cases billion-dollar fines of multiple billion-dollar fines that have been coming out. There aren't actual criminal prosecutions in that while the fines seem very significant on paper, almost unprecedented in a number of cases, they're a drop in the bucket for these major financial companies. And so this is one of the challenges. And I think part of that is reflected of this stepped up effort to go after major financial institutions was taking place during the financial crisis.
Uh-huh.
And so you wanted to punish the banks, but many of these banks that were already fragile, you didn't want to destabilize them. So yes, the U.S. government potentially did pull their punches, but I think on the other side is that they have been consistent in going after lots of different banks and kind of credibly making the case that more and more, if you are a financial institution and you rely on U.S. business, the U.S. government can and will go after you. So it hasn't been as severe as response as maybe deserved, given the damage done to U.S. foreign policy interests. But I think it is starting to affect the behavior of major financial institutions.
So, Professor Brian Early, when you were doing your research, did you find people on the inside who were willing to talk to you about all of this?
Not a lot. I mean, I went over and actually lived in the Emirate of Dubai for a month doing research, and I was able to go down to the areas where U.S. products were being loaded up onto ships to go across to Iran.
In violation of the sanctions.
Yeah, well, it was illegal from a U.S. perspective, some of that trade, but it's perfectly legal in countries like the United Arab Emirates. And so I was able to go down there. I was able to see it, but not too many people wanted to talk to me about those transactions. And I mean, for obvious reasons. I mean, if discretion is what's making you money, then it doesn't pay to talk to journalists or academics who are asking uncomfortable questions. Yeah.
Talk to me about political parties. Now, when we talk about sanctions as a policy of the U.S. government, You have the Bush administration. You have the current Obama administration. Are there major differences when it comes to the imposition of sanctions?
There are to some extent. I think that President Obama has actually embraced the use of economic sanctions
and drones. I'm just kidding.
But if you look at the most recent national security strategy, I mean, it is chock full of references to the use of economic sanctions to solve American foreign policy and national security challenges. The most recent policy issued by the U.S. government to respond to cyber attacks and hacking with sanctions is just illustrative of the Obama administration's, I think, real, I don't know if I want to say fondness, but real reliance upon economic sanctions as a major tool of U.S. foreign policy. And to some extent, I think if you look at the Obama administration's position is that he wants to be somewhat less interventionalist, and economic sanctions allow the U.S. to do something. But it avoids potentially taking a more proactive stance that would require military strikes or further engagement.
So we don't want boots on the ground, and economic sanctions are one of the things that will satisfy both the national constituency voters and also might bring you something back.
It could. And I mean, this is another part, to be fair to economic sanctions as a tool of statecraft. In some cases, if you do nothing, you can't expect the situation to change. And even if you impose sanctions and there's a low likelihood that they'll succeed, sometimes they do. So there is a aspect of this, of imposing sanctions might be better than nothing. But I think policymakers need to do a better job of taking into account that there could be some counterproductive effects of sanctions. So as I mentioned, sanctions sometimes are imposed to improve human rights. Well, sanctioned countries tend to have worse human rights records. Sanctions are imposed to help democratize countries. Well, if the research shows that sanctioned countries tend to become more authoritarian. So there are a number of these findings that show that sanctions actually can be counterproductive to the goals in which they're imposed.
Is there a sense abroad among our allies, among people we deal with, that we impose sanctions unfairly? In other words, some get them and some don't.
Yes. And I think that has made it more challenging for the United States to convince countries to not only join the sanctioning efforts, but even to respect U.S. sanctions and not actively undercut them. If you look back to kind of a running example, we've been talking about the sanctions against Cuba. The U.S. made the sanctioning Cuba a major hemispheric issue within the Organization of American States and twisted all these arms of countries in Latin America and Central America to make them impose sanctions against Cuba in the 60s and early 70s. And finally, these countries got fed up. They did not think that sanctioning Cuba was fair. They thought it was costly for them with no real tangible benefit, and they revolted and quit the U.S. sanctioning effort. And you've seen a great deal of hostility within the international community to U.S. sanctions, especially since the end of the Cold War. So, I think
does that create a bully reputation of the United States when they do this?
It can, and I think that's one where the U.S. sanctioning strategy in Latin America has hurt the United States' reputation, and it's allowed people like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela when he was a president to really claim that the U.S. is a bully and needs to be not viewed as a cooperative, helpful partner that provides leadership in a hemisphere, but it's an adversary or a bully that pushes countries around. So I think that there are some political costs to U.S. sanctions as well that more broadly affect the United States' reputation.
Professor, what happens if Iran works out? In other words, if the negotiations with the Iranians work out, there's going to be no more touching, you know, or building nuclear stuff for 10 years or maybe 15 years, and it turns out to be perceived as a good thing for Obama. Does this mean we're going to have a lot more sanctions in the future?
I think that this is kind of a difficult argument to make because to some extent, you could argue that economic sanctions have contributed to the insecurity within Iran and contributed to the motivations that the Iranian leaders had for why they wanted to acquire nuclear weapons potentially to begin with. And if you look at the statements of the Supreme Leader, economic sanctions and the additional damages that they've been able to impose in the past 5 years have gotten the Iranians to the negotiating table. But at the same time, the economic sanctions have also become an impediment to moving the negotiations ahead. And these are not just the economic sanctions on Iran's nuclear program, but these are the sanctions we impose for democracy, for counterterrorism, for a number of reasons.
Some of which have turned out to be unfortunate.
Yeah. If the economic, if this deal does get brokered, I think we could say that economic sanctions finally, after several decades, did get the Iranians to come to the negotiating table and broker a grand deal. But I think there's a significant possibility that the sanctions could become an impediment to the deal ever being reached, especially if folks within Congress argue that they're not going to lift the sanctions in as rapid of a time frame as the Iranians want them to be lifted.
Now, Professor, I often wonder about this kind of thing. You've basically written a book, and you've laid it something out. You say, busted sanctions, they don't work. Sanctions don't work because they're busted, and that's your thing. But we've talked about a great deal today, in which case I think I've heard you say, in some cases, they do work.
So I try to be a little bit more sophisticated in my book. I try to argue that economic sanctions often fail, and the reason they do is that you have the United States adversaries who are aiding sanctioned countries, and its allies and other countries that are profitably undercutting them. Where I get to at the end of my book is that recognizing that there are other countries that threaten the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions, we can make better policy decisions about when using economic sanctions is going to be appropriate, when there's a high likelihood of them being busted. But we can also then recognize that there are certain countries in the international system that represent the greatest peril to the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions and subject them to additional engagement to try to either get their cooperation or at the very least get them to stop undercutting U.S. sanctions. And so one of the I don't know if it's a feel-good story, but you did see since I started writing my book
10 years
ago,
yeah, right.
The United Arab Emirates has come around and agreed to cooperate with U.S. and international sanctions against Iran in a much, much greater capacity.
And we don't really know what their motivations were.
Well, I mean,
it could be.
They were mixed. I mean, a number of potential commercial and political motivations, and Iran is one of the greatest security threats that the country of the United Arab Emirates has.
Sure.
So there were mixed motives. But if you know that the problem exists and you can identify the countries or the companies that are facilitating it, you can develop much better policies to make U.S. sanctions more effective. And that's what I have seen from U.S. policymakers, particularly in the past 5 years or so. So it's a challenge that's always going to be present when U.S. uses economic sanctions. But if we understand it and we develop some more sophisticated approaches, then the problem can be at least somewhat mitigated.
Well, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you real quickly. But the premise, when we install the sanctions, has in the past not always been the correct premise about what we want to achieve, right?
Yeah, I think that
we took out Saddam Hussein and things got worse. So,
I mean, we can impose economic sanctions for a large number of reasons, and whether or not they're going to be effective in different issue areas really does vary. In the case of Saddam Hussein, it's argued that the sanctions at the very least did really undermine the Iraqis' ability to field a nuclear program, at least in those limited sense. They didn't change Saddam Hussein's mentality, but they in that case did at least undermine his capacity to some extent.
Yeah, and look where we are now.
Yeah. not in a good situation in that part of the world.
Somebody wasn't thinking six steps ahead.
You're right. And so, I mean, this gets into kind of broader debates about whether the United States, in using its power, is best served by adopting coercive strategies, or sometimes adopting strategies that are more based on engagement and a little less heavy-handed.
So you took 10 years to write this book. Did you think all along that it would get done?
I think any academic who takes on a
been
big
there,
project.
Been there, done it.
Yeah. You definitely have your moments where you question whether it will ever be complete. But I tell you what, when you get the book finished, it's and see it out in the world. It was published in February. It is one of the proudest moments that I think I've had in my life.
But there's always a little postpartum. What do I do now? Now that the baby is born, you may have a little depression.
Yeah, I'm lucky in that I have a number of different kind of areas of research. I'm very interested in weapons of mass destruction and security issues, and those are closely related to sanctions issues. And so, I've got a lot of different projects that I can work on. And one of the great things about studying weapons of mass destruction and economic sanctions is those are issues that aren't going away anytime soon.
And now you're the expert.
And now I'm working towards becoming
the
expert.
Oh, you are the expert.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very nice compliment.
We've been talking to Professor Brian Early, assistant professor in the Political Science Department, Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, University of Albany, and author of Busted Sanctions, Explaining Why Economic Sanctions Fail, published by the prestigious Stanford University Press in 2015. Brian, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
We're out of time, and we'll see you all on the next Conversations.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.